first of all, welcome for this one but last session at Tech Days. I think it's very brave of you to attend the session on storage, especially level 401. So thanks for that. My name is Yves Goeleven. I'm actually a local guy. I work for Capgemini Belgium, and my role can be described as a solution architect. So I design systems for customers, either on the enterprise or either in the cloud. Cloud is my specialization, though. I'm also an MVP for Windows Azure for the past 3 years. Besides my main job, I also am a serial innovator, or a serial workaholic, if you like. So I do a lot of things outside. I founded a user group here in Belgium on Windows Azure called AZUG. I also started a few online projects, wholeven.com and messagehandler.net. And I'm also an open source contributor for InServiceBus. So some of you might know me from one of those contexts. The topic for today is Windows Azure Storage. The talk consists of two parts. One is a deep dive into the architecture of the storage services. So we will not be talking about how you use storage. We will actually be talking about how it works internally. Right? So it's not about using, it's about knowing. And the second part is about what I call best practices. Well, to be honest, they are my practices, so you can decide whether or not they are the best. We will go through the different layers of the architecture one by one, and we will also look into four of the strategies that I apply during my projects. Of course, those strategies are derived from my knowledge of the internal workings of the service. Okay, I do want to warn you, this is a level 400 session. I have let a few people review the slide decks. They actually said I should up the number to 666. So it might be a little bit challenging. Okay, next slide. So I do assume that you know what storage services are. I do assume that you know that this is a highly scalable, highly available storage system. I also assume that you know that it offers a few abstractions out of the box, being tables, blobs, drives, and queues, all right? Is there anybody in the room who has never worked with storage before? Yeah, it might be challenging, okay? So I assume that you know about it. I also assume that you've already figured out by practice that this thing is not a relational database, right? This is a problem I see a lot when doing consulting work. I see people using the services, and because there is a nice SDK on top of the services that supports Link, is that they will start falling into a database-oriented mindset. It's not the case. If you think of them like another SQL server, then you will run into trouble very fast. Okay? But I'll explain how to work with it in the proper way, or at least my view. This talk is pretty academic. It's based on a white paper, so all the information that I will be talking about is publicly available on the URL at the bottom. This has been published by Microsoft, and it refers to a lot of other documents, protocols and stuff that they used from, for example, other big cloud vendors like Google. So there is a lot of information in there. Okay? So what's actually described in that document is how they actually managed to build a system that defies the CAP theorem. I hope you guys know what the CAP theorem is. Basically, it says that it's impossible to build a system that is both consistent, available, and can handle network partitioning. Okay, so it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to build a system to do that. Now, it's not impossible. They did it. But now we're going to look into how they did it. Okay, so these were like 10 slides to convince you whether or not this talk was for you. I will not be offended if you leave the room right now. But if you don't, I do expect a level 5 rating for my session. Okay, the first topic that we will be looking into is the global namespace. So we will look at the service from a top-down view, and we will start from a global perspective, so from the planet. Just think we have the planet, the internet. So every time that you construct a query, a link expression or something, it actually translates into an HTTP web request. Right? The HTTP web request is sent at a specific address, of which four parts are replaceable, being the account name, the service, the partition name, and the object name. The account name That's what's assigned when you sign up. You choose a storage account name. That's actually pointing to a certain data center or a certain part in the data center. Right? The service name is to be replaced by either tables, blobs, storage queues, as part of the subsystem of storage. Right? In fact, there is no real difference between the three if you look at it from an architecture point of view, but there is a difference from a usage point of view. So it might be that your tables are in a different location in the data center than your blobs. Okay? But architecturally, it's exactly the same. The partition name and the object name is something that is specific to the service type, so the pattern will vary a little bit between tables, blobs, and queues. The first part is actually part of the DNS global infrastructure. So the first part, the host name, will actually be resolved when you send the web request to a certain data center of Microsoft, and more specifically to a certain virtual IP address within that data center. Now, this thing that it's pointing at is called a stamp. Is everybody of you aware between the difference of a virtual IP address and a dynamic IP address in Azure? Who is not? Okay. So a virtual IP address can be thought of as the IP address of the logical load balancer. It's not the IP address of your machines. It's just a global IP that will remain stable during the lifetime of your service. It will not change. The dynamic IP address is the real IP address internally, and that changes all the time. Okay? All the time, often. So we're explicitly talking here about the virtual IP address of a stamp. So that's a load balancer of some subsystem of storage. And that's what a stamp is. A stamp is a scale unit within the storage system. Right? So it actually consists of three different layers. It's a regular Windows Azure platform as a service cloud service, so it's subject to the fabric controller. If a machine dies, it will automatically spin up a new one, etc. So it's just the same thing as a traditional cloud service that you own, with one big difference, is that it has disks attached. So it has special disks. Depending on when the storage account is created, it's either 3 petabytes of disk, 2 petabytes, sorry, or 30 petabytes of disk. Inside of the stamp, so inside of the the group of servers, there are typically 20 racks, which should, in my calculations, translate to roughly 360 extra large instances. Okay, so if you ever need to go beyond that, you might consider getting a second storage account. You will probably do it earlier, but still, that's probably the physical limit. Okay, what's important in the stamp is that there is replication internally. So at the disk level, at the stream layer level actually, the bits that you actually write to the disks are copied 3 times. Okay, that's important. What's also important is that... We'll come back to that one later. So what happens if a request is arriving at the stamp? Then first it comes in at the load balancer. Yeah, what? Through the DNS system. Then it gets sent to the front-end server. So these front-end nodes, they have the responsibility of routing the requests to the correct part of the stamp, because the stamp is also very big, 360 servers. It has to send it somewhere. And that somewhere is called the partition server. And that partition is calculated based on the account name, the partition name, and the object name. Typically, when the request arrives at the partition server, it will be read from memory. So this might surprise you a little bit. It's actually already present, typically, in the memory of a partition server. And it will just simply return back to you. Okay? So for every request that you perform, there are actually 2 physical machines involved in serving it. But still, this is blazingly fast. So if you've used it, you noticed, especially if you do it from within Azure, right? It might be a little bit slower if you use it from home. But if you use it from within Azure, it's very, very fast. And that's because of the network topology that sits beneath. It's called a flat network topology that they nicknamed Quantum 10. This is state-of-the-art invented software or topologies by Microsoft. And with that topology, they actually managed to aggregate all of the bandwidth of the entire data center together and make it available for the storage nodes. So this delivers 50 terabits per second of bandwidth. So there's actually no limit to the nodes themselves from a data center point of view. But there is one limit, and that's the speed of the NIC that is deployed in the machine. Right? And that's 10 gigabits per second. But still, that's a lot more than a typical SSD drive that you have. Typically, SSD drives are somewhere around 6 gigabit per second, while these are 10. Okay? So actually, even though you have network hops, but because the network is so amazingly fast, you will not notice. It will be faster than a disk. Okay? That's important to know, because during the rest of the talk, you will see that this thing is copying files all over the time, so it has to be very, very fast. Now, in case of a write, so if you do an update or an insert or a delete, then we cannot obviously not read it from memory. Then we need to make sure that the data is accepted, and we also need to make sure that the data is replicated within the three copies of the system. This is done, surprisingly, in a synchronous fashion. So that actually means that if a request comes in from the front-end layer, the partition server will push it to what we call an extend node. I will cover all of these servers later, right, in detail. But it will send it to what's called a primary extend node. The primary extend node is the master of the replication, basically. It will not immediately return back to the partition server, but it will synchronously forward it to a second secondary, or first secondary, and then that secondary will forward it again, if my clicker works, to the third node. Okay? It's only when the third node is written that the third node says to the second one, I'm done, and the second one says to the primary, I'm done, and then it's replicated back to the partition server. Okay? So this is done synchronously. But we can do it synchronously because it's so blazingly fast that it doesn't really impact the performance. And then it returns, obviously, to you. So, geo-replication is also a very nice feature that a lot of people like when they use storage. Now, geo-replication is conceptually the same as intra-stamp replication, but it doesn't actually happen at the disk level. It happens way later in the life cycle, and it happens at the partition server level. So it's a piece of software talking to another piece of software copying data over. The disks are not immediately involved. I will discuss later how it exactly works. But the important thing is that there is an external system, external to the storage system, called the location service, that's actually responsible for coordinating the geo-replication process between the different stamps. Okay? So you have to think about it now. Whenever you create a new storage account, you actually get access to 360 servers on that side and 360 servers on another side. And typically, unless you opt out, these servers are spread across the continent. So not across the globe, but across the continent. So in our case, if you open something on Amsterdam, then the replica will be in Dublin. Okay? You can opt out of that, so if you have legal issues with being in Dublin, you can actually ask Microsoft during the creation of the storage account to keep everything local. In that case, you still have two stamps, but they are in the same data center. Okay? It's still the location service that's actually responsible for that. Technically, it does this by managing the DNS records. So it's actually pretty simple. It's just a DNS update, like you do a DNS update when you go to your DNS provider. Right. But through this DNS update, it can do several things. One is, it can determine which of the two stamps are actually active for your storage account. Okay? So if you create a new storage account, you say, I want to have it active in Amsterdam. So it chooses a stamp in Amsterdam. But it also maintains a list of stamps in Dublin or one stamp that will act as a failover for you. So it's involved in assigning accounts. It's also involved, as I said, in geo-replication. And because it geo-replicates, it's also involved in disaster recovery. Now, one thing that a lot of people think is that disaster recovery is automated. That's not the case. It's for the entire stamp level. So Microsoft will only decide to switch over from one stamp to the other if everything on that stamp is dead. So if your storage account is dead for some reason, then it will not automatically fail over to the other one. It's a manual action to be done by Microsoft. And we've seen an outage, I think, in the beginning of the year that's caused by the decision, the conscious decision of Microsoft to not fail over. So it's a manual action, and because some very crucial systems were still running, they decided not to fail over, which was an outage for the rest of the world, basically. But okay, we were not that important at that moment. It's also involved in load balancing. So it keeps tracks of how full the stamps are, and then it can use that information to decide where the storage account will be. And it's also involved in account migration. So if you ever have to migrate your data from Dublin to the US, for example, you can ask that through Microsoft support, and they will ask the location service to do that for you. So that's the location service. I'm not going in depth into that one because it's actually outside of the storage system. The one that's inside is the first of the three layers, being the front-end layer. And the front-end layer is just another Windows Azure platform as a service deployment, so a cloud service. It's stateless, it doesn't have disks attached, and it has four responsibilities. One is doing authentication authorization, so whenever you pass in your storage account, that one is validated by the front-end layers. And the same goes for the shared access signatures that you might have used already on blobs to expose them. So anything related to security authentication authorization, SSL certificates as well, belongs here. So the second responsibility of those machines is doing the routing to the partition servers. And it does that based on partition map. A partition map is also an in-memory structure, so it's in the memory of the front-end nodes. And it can actually be used to look up to which partition server a certain request has to be sent. I will go into in-depth on that one in the next slide. It's also responsible for versioning. So as you might have noticed, over the months and years that storage has been available, there were new versions of the API available. All versions are still supported, and you can specify the version that you want in a version header. Okay? It's responsible for that. If you choose a different version as the API protocol, it will actually route you differently within the system to other partition servers. And furthermore, it's also responsible for throttling. You know that there are throttles on both your table partition and both your storage account. So it's respectively, I think, 2,000 requests a second and 20,000 requests a second. And that's all handled by the front-end nodes. Okay? But these things do not have disks. It's just a simple, basic role, web role, that actually does all the things. Right. Where is my next one? Come on, man. So this partition map thingy. This partition map is actually an in-memory construct that is available in the front-end nodes. But it's only read by the front-end. So it's not managed by the front-end server. It's actually managed by another system called the partition managers, which is part of the partition layer. You can conceptually think about it as a dictionary, but one that is ordered. So all the entries inside of the partition map are actually just key value pairs, but that come in a certain order. That order is alphabetical, and it's based on both the account name, the name of the service, the partition name, and the object name. So this combination of values together points to a certain machine in the partition layer, being the partition server. This allows the system to actually split up all of the different data that's in there into what we call partition ranges. So if you have records, for example, in table storage, and they have different partition keys, then they will be grouped into ranges of partitions and kept together if possible. I'll explain that process as well. So from practical examples, so if you, for example, have blobs, then every individual blob is a partition. You know that blobs contain blocks or pages. Those are actually the parts that are partitioned inside of the blob partition. So one blob is a partition. And the name of the blob URI actually determines where in the partition range that it will be. So if you have, for example, my account, my container, subdir, file 1, and my account, my container, subdir, file 2, because these are alphabetically close in order, it's very likely that they will be hosted in the same partition range. So they will probably be hosted by the same machine. If you have something like my account, other container, which is a few letters apart at the O and the M, then it's possible that this blob is hosted on another server. Right? So you have to take that into account. You never have to think about that when you access an individual blob. So if you read pages or blocks from a blob, they will all come from the same machine, guaranteed. But if you start listing blobs across in a folder, for example, then it might be that you have to query multiple servers to get your full list. For the queue, it's roughly the same as for blobs. Every queue on its own is a partition. The messages in the queues are obviously the entities in the partition. And as the name of the queue, that determines the range. Range, again, here only matters for listings, but, well, very few people will start listing all of their queues. Usually, they just read the messages from their queues, so it's not that important. Typically, you don't have to think about partitioning in this case. In the case of table, it's very different. In a table, that every group of rows that has the same partition key value is also a partition. So, and in, within this partition, you have this other value called row key. And row key is actually determined for the order within the partition. That's very important. I often hear people referring to row keys as the primary keys. That's not the case. It's a, basically, it's an order by clause that you can use. But in this case, the range matters a lot because you will be querying tables very often because, well, you use it as a table most of the time. And that might be a little bit problematic because if you do a give me all my users, for example, query, and you have a million users, then they will be spread out across I don't know how many machines, likely. Okay. And that's in this scenario, you have to keep into account that the storage service will not give you all of the data. They will just give you the data of one of the partitions. And it gives you something called a token, a continuation token, that you can then use to query the service again. So continuation tokens, you might get them in case you start querying in a certain table across partitions if not all of the same data happens to be on the same machine. So if you have, by accident, all of your data in your query is on the same machine, you will just simply get one result back. But if it is split or there are just too many results, then you will get the data back, including a continuation token, and you are supposed to be sequentially query the service continually until you do not get a continuation token again. Now, this might be okay for one or two queries, but if you have a million queries to go through in your give me the list of people query, that might become problematic. Right? So you have to take it into account, and the sad part of this is that you typically only notice this in production. Because when you're developing, you do not have a lot of data, or you do not trigger the conditions for the services, for the partition layer to actually split out everything. So it will be on one machine, and it will be very performant. And then you go live, and then everything slows down. Okay? So you have to think about this upfront. Expect the continuation tokens. All right. Now let's talk about the internals of that partition layer thing. So front-end was actually quite simple. You just don't have to think about too much. This one is pretty difficult. Okay, the partition layer on its own is a group of servers that is responsible for maintaining what is called a dynamic scalable object index. Index in the same sense as that you know indexes from databases. So it's a lookup table that points to records. Yes. But the big difference here is that these servers actually maintain this index, this logical index, as one big group. So there are only things that are called object tables, and these define the accounts, the entities, the blobs, the messages, the schemas, and the partition map. So whatever you think you're doing when you create a table, that doesn't actually create a table. That just simply creates extra records in the entity table. So all entities, mine, yours, your neighbors, all same table. Okay, it's one big table. This big table is then split across the machines continuously. And this is what's called a dynamic load balancing algorithm. So these partition servers, they continuously every 15 seconds look at the usage of the different records and then decide to cut it into pieces and spread it across all of those machines. Okay? So all of these partitions are spread across the different partition services, and that's based on load. So if you have a very, very popular record, then everything that's surrounding that record will probably be moved away to another machine. That's how you need to think about it. But it's amazing that they can do it in every 15 seconds, especially at this scale. Now, there are several machines involved in this process. The master of everything is called the partition manager. This one is responsible for the allocation algorithm. It calculates, based on the load, how it should partition the different object tables across the different partition servers. And it performs this dynamically, so it keeps a go. The partition server on its own, this one is responsible for giving you the data. So for serving your queries from memory, or accepting your commands to insert, update, and delete. To do the last, it needs to manage things that we call streams. And streams can be considered as very big files, but these files are not on the machines of the partition servers, but they are on the layer below called the stream layer. Okay? So you can think of them as files. In reality, they are more than files, but they just simply write to them. And then we have a third service called the lock service. And this one is responsible for allowing the other tools to take locks on certain resources. So in case of the partition master, it allows them to do master election. So one of those partitioning management machines is going to do the load balancing, but while it's doing the load balancing, none of the other partition managers should start a new load balancing. So they can take a lock on a certain set of data, and nobody else can start the dynamic load balancing process whenever that lock exists. The same for the partition server. Every partition server is responsible for giving the data for one certain partition range, so a set of partitions, and none of the other machines can serve that partition. Okay, because it needs to manage the data, the write data. Especially during write, it's important. Okay. So how does this conceptually work? Imagine that we have the following table. These are blobs. It starts with the letter A. It's alphabetically organized. And we have Harry's pictures, we have Richard's images, and we have Zizi. Right? There are millions of other rows or whatever, a lot. And in this case, the partition manager will take a look on the lock service. It will say, I am going to do the partitioning of the blob table. Remember, it's one big table, right? All of my blobs, your blobs, everything, one big table. Then it will look, based on the load matrix of the data, where the hot segments in the tables are. And it will mark them. So in this case, it has decided that Harry's sunset picture is very, very popular, as well as Richard's soccer image. And it will decide to split at that boundary. Then it will always do it in three. So it's always whatever comes before a popular piece, whatever comes after a popular piece, always split like that. It will never split in two pieces. Okay, it's important to know. Then it will choose three partition servers in the system for moving the different partitions. And it will say to the first one, well, from now on, you're responsible from A to H. And the second one, you're from H accent to R. And the third one, you're responsible for the rest. Okay. And then again, every of these partition servers says to the lock server, well, I am now responsible for this range. And this happens all the time over and over again. So these partition managers are continuously looking at the table, are continuously assigning, reassigning, and telling everybody, now you're responsible for that part. This is very easy to do because the partition servers actually just are simply memory services. They only have data in memory, and all of the data is on the underlying layer, and it can be read from there. So even if a partition server crashes, and it's stateful because it has everything in memory, they can quickly swap to another partition server and make that one responsible for the new partition range or for the lost partition range. So these partition managers, they actually take care of the fact that all of the data, which is hot, which has been used in recent times, is actually present in the memory of the partition servers. Okay, that's why it's very fast. Okay, now once the data has been assigned to the different partition servers and the locks have been established, then it will create a new version of the partition map and upload that one to all of the front-end nodes so that they can start routing data from the front-end nodes to the correct partition servers. Here is a very small window in which you might get an exception during querying. So it could be that a certain part of the partition map is being rewritten at the moment that you do a query to it and it's locked. So you will get an exception, and then it's when you're supposed to do a retry. That's why all of the SDKs have the retry five times logic in them, so that you actually do not notice that it fails one time and then you have to query it again. It will succeed the second or the third time because it's just simply a file copy operation. It will go very fast, but still it may happen. These are the transient errors that you can expect in table storms. Okay? All right. So, important, it's not really in the critical path. So all of the calculations, all of the updates and stuff will not influence your queries, except for that very small moment where they update the partition map. Okay? So they can do it at runtime. You will not notice unless you decide not to use the retry mechanism. Okay. Now on to the partition server. So remember, they serve all the data from memory. This is a pretty complex part of the service. The internals of the partition server follow a pattern called the log structured merge tree. That means that they both have a persistent part, in this case being four streams, so remember four files, four logical files, as well as a set of memory caches that actually contain all of the data that they want to see queried. The four log streams, one is metadata. This one is the changes in partition ranges and accounts that are being hosted by the partition server. So remember that the reallocation happens every 15 seconds. All of the changes during the reallocation are maintained in the partition map, so that they, in case there is an error during a repartitioning, that they can fall back to the previous one. That's the reason. Then the most important one is probably the commit log. And the commit log actually accepts all of the changes to the data itself. So every time you have an insert, update, or delete statement, that will be appended to the commit log. The raw data, that's basically the raw data in snapshots. So basically it works the same as a SQL server, where you have a transaction log, that's the same as a commit log, as well as your data files, which is in this case the raw data. So these are snapshots of the actual last state of your record. And then we have a special one for the blob service, which is the blob data. Because raw data can be used for messages, can be used for records from table storage, but because blobs are very big, they don't fit in there. So what they actually do is they have another stream, being the blob data stream, where the actual data is written. And then the raw data contains the positions inside of the blobs data where the blocks begin. Okay. So this is a two-step. I will not talk about the blob data stream anymore, but because the process is just simply the same as being a raw data stream, but it's repeated two times, so it's a little bit slower. Okay. Then the caches in memory that we can find, the memory table. This is simply a copy of the commit log. So every change, update, insert, delete in the table that you do will be written to the commit log and written to the memory table. You will see later why. The raw cache, this contains all of the data from the raw data stream in memory that has been recently accessed. And that's where most of the data is being searched from whenever you do a query. So this is the actual data, the snapshot of the current state of your table. Then we have index cache. And the index cache contains pointers through the positions in the raw data stream, so that you can easily retrieve certain parts of the raw data if it's not available in the raw data cache. And then you have Bloom filters. Bloom filters is a special algorithm, basically, that has been designed to answer one particular question, being, is the data on this machine or not? And it answers with no or maybe. Okay? But still, it's better to know that the answer is no than start querying all of the streams, because these are very big files. So it's a performance game, basically. And then furthermore, it also continuously tracks its own load metrics. It knows which of the partitions are accessed frequently, so that this information can then be used as input for the dynamic load balancing algorithm. Okay? So quite a complex architecture, and I will now explain you how it works when you read data and update data. So whenever you do read, so whenever you do select on a certain partition, and the data is hot, meaning that it has been recently accessed, then your incoming request will first hit the raw cache, and it will find the data there. So the data is present, it will just simply be grabbed from the raw cache. But this is a snapshot information, so it's information that might actually be a little bit old. In sense of old, we're talking milliseconds, right? But it might be old. It is then, because it's old, considered old, it will be merged with all of the latest changes to that data that's coming from the memory table. So here is a merge process going on, where you take the source information, you take the change set from the latest changes, and you merge it together. And this also performs duplicate detection. So if there are duplicate records in there, it will filter it out. So you will not get duplicate records. This will be important in when we talk about the stream layer. So remember that. So it actually hits two tables in memory. It merges the records. That's why it's called the log structured merge tree. Right? It merges. And it will return you the latest result set. If it's cold data, it's different. Then it will come in. We'll look at the raw cache, which will not find the data. It's not there. So we need to go to the disk. We need to go to the other machine, the extent nodes, the stream layer, where the data is. So it's pretty relatively expensive operation. So we first go and check whether the data is here, it might be here or might not be here. Okay? If the answer is, well, maybe it's here, then we can look at the other cache. Then, yeah, where is it? Okay? This is a list of pointers in the raw data stream where certain data can be found. If we can find the location, then we can go directly with the random access read, go into the raw data stream, pull the data, grab it, merge it with the latest changes, we need to do that, and then send it back to the user. Okay? So we hit the cache, not there, we check the Bloom filters, maybe here, we check the index cache, it's located there, we go fetch it, we merge it with the latest changes, and we send it back. Okay. Now, I see many questioning faces. Why the hell so difficult if you just simply could return the latest result set? Well, the problem is that there are a lot of reads and writes going on at the same time. And that's why they actually split out the actual data and the changes into separate files and separate memory tables, so that they can actually guarantee the performance on the write operations. And that's the next step. If you do an insert or an update, then you do not want to go seek in this gigantic raw data stream for your data. You just want to say, hey, I got your update or I got your insert, and it's okay for me, I will handle it. So in terms of a write request, they will actually only update the commit log stream. They will append it to the commit log stream, and they will append it to the memory table, and then they tell you, it's okay, we're done. Because they have received the data, and it's safely stored on the stream layer. It's already replicated 3 times, right? So it's safely stored there. The only difference is that the actual data files, the raw data stream, is not yet updated. But we can definitely tell you, we're done, it's okay. And this is for performance reasons. You don't want to be waiting for a seek in a 3 terabyte file to go and look for your location to be updated. Okay? You just want to know it's okay. Now, obviously, at a certain moment, we will have to replicate out the data to the rest of the system, so that it can be easily retrieved. because snapshot is easier to read than a list of logs. And that's what's called the checkpoint process. This happens asynchronously, so outside of the scope of any of your requests. You don't notice it. It's continuously going on. And what actually happens is that the changes in the commit log stream will be merged into the raw data stream. Now, what is important is the raw data stream system is an append-only system, so it's impossible to change existing data. So what they do is they grab the old one, manipulate it to memory, and then save a new stream. So they will copy data all of the time. But that's okay, because they have a very fast network, and they can just do that over the 10 gigabit connection. And then, once the raw data stream has been updated with the new information, then we can do a commit log update, because we don't need the old commits anymore. We have done the update, we have done the delete, we have done the insert. So we can actually shrink that one, but again, it's not really shrinking, it's copying, but just into a smaller file. Then the original files, they are not deleted, but they are forgotten. So this is a very huge system. They can just simply leave the file there and forget about it. Okay? The partition manager stops tracking the old string. Once that is done, it will update the memory table with a new commit log structure. And it can also update the index cache and maybe even the row cache if the data was hot. Okay? Which is likely because you were just writing to the data. Okay. Now, why do they do this? Why do they write everything to this commit log? And it's all because of the replication process between the data centers, the geo-replication. Because once you have this commit log file, and you have this checkpoint process that actually takes the commit log and then rolls it out across of your nodes, actually makes it very easy to do geo-replication. Because the only thing that you need to do is copy the commit log file. You do not have to do anything else. So every time that the location service says to the partition server, now do a geo-replication, it just grabs one file, sends it over the wire, and it copies it in the other data center. So something like this. And then, because there is a checkpoint process in the other data center as well, it will do the same thing. So all of the changes, all of the state changes from one data center will automatically be applied into the next one, with a little bit of delay, of course. Right? I think the scale target there is something like 5 minutes to actually have the other data center in the same state. But this is now very easy. For people who have ever tried to do data sync across a database, they know how hard it is to actually keep all of the tables in sync. And with this mechanism, by just simply being able to copy the commit log to the other data center and then have the changes reapplied there, it's actually fairly easy to do. Okay? That's why you get it for free, or almost for free, in Azure Storage. Okay? Is this clear? Next one, stream layer. Now we go even deeper. Right? So we've had things all in memory up until now. We've had the front-end nodes. They do not maintain anything in memory. We have the partition servers. They maintain everything in memory. And then we have the stream layer, and they actually do everything on disk. So these machines have disks attached. This stream layer can be considered as an append-only distributed file system. It has some competitors in the space called GFS, Google File System. You might have heard about that. Basically, it works in a similar way. Streams can be considered as very large files, and they are in a data or in a directory-like structure. And you can do the same things on them, like you can do with regular files. With one difference, you cannot write in the middle of the file. You can only append. But you can do all of the other stuff. You can open, close, delete, rename, concatenate stuff together. And you can randomly read. So you can start in the middle of file reading, but you cannot start writing in the middle of the file. That's because they want to replicate it out. But these are not really physical files. They are just logical files. They're also terabytes in space. They have no real limit. They are just very big. Now, inside of what's conceptually a stream, you will find something called a block. And a block is the minimum unit of read and write. So that's what's actually written to the disk. For every block, they maintain a checksum. This is to prevent bit rot. You know that disks decay over time, So you will lose files because of these bits flipping from 1 to 0 or the other way. So they maintain a checksum so that they can at all times check whether or not the file is still valid. And then these files do not have a real fixed size, but the size is typically small. It's a few megabytes typically. Right? So this is block. You write blocks next to next. And these blocks are grouped together in something that is called an extent. Remember extent node, right? That's where the name comes from. The extent node is actually the unit of replication. So it's a group of blocks, and they will be replicated across the extent nodes as a whole. They will not be replicated individually. It will be an entire extent node that will be copied over. These have a size limit. So typically it's 1 gigabyte. If they reach 1 gigabyte, the extent is being sealed. And sealed means you cannot write to it anymore. This is another terminology. It's very important during failure handling. You have sealed extents. You have unsealed extents. So unsealed, still writable. Sealed is basically read-only. Okay? Remember those terms. So sealed, we have the new unsealed extent. We add blocks to it. Voila, it's full. We seal it. We start another one. More blocks, and so forth. Now, a stream is actually nothing but another file with pointers to the start of all of these extents. Where are these extents on the disks? Of which machine? That's important. The extents themselves are spread across the different extent nodes. So the first extent and the second extent are not on the same node necessarily. But they are pointed to from the stream. So that's why the streams can be so big. They can be terabytes in size, but actually they are just simple logical pointers to even more files that actually contain the data. Okay, make sense? So they are logically terabytes in size, not physically on the disk. Physically they are probably very small because it's just simply addresses on the disk, offsets on a machine. Okay? These are append-only because they point to other stuff. You cannot change that, really. But it's very easy because they are logically very big but physically very small. It's very easy to start copying and appending them and doing all kinds of tricks with that. And that's why all of the streams being managed by the partition server can actually be very simply copied during an append or a shrink operation. Okay? So streams are files of pointers that point to other files, and those files contain blocks, and those files might be read-only or might be written to. Okay? Blocks, that's the unit being written. Extent, that's the file which you can either write to or not write to. And streams, which contain lists, is a list of pointers to those other files. All right. That's logically. We also have some machines in there. And we have two types of machines, one being stream masters and one being the extent nodes. This works pretty similar to in the partition server. You have the guys in charge and you have the guys doing the work. The stream masters are actually based on a system called Paxos, so it's actually a set of protocols. It's very old, from 1989 or something. And this thing is a distributed consensus protocol. So they are just talking to each other, basically. Do we agree on what the size of that block is or that extent is? They are consistently talking to each other to keep track of the state of the system. The extent nodes, those are the machines with the disks attached. And they physically manage the extents. So they will add blocks to it. They will seal them. They will also have optimization routines that shrink them, that make them more easy handleable once they're on disk. Okay, so they manage the actual files. Okay, now how does it work? Whenever a new partition server comes up and it wants a new stream, then it will tell the stream master, hey, I would like you to create a new stream or a new extent. It can be both. In this case, the stream master will actually pick 3 random machines in the data center, in the stamp, and it will allocate the structure of the stream that it wants to write to those 3 machines. Okay? Why 3 different machines? Well, it's because of the primary, the secondary, and the second secondary extent nodes that actually need to contain all of the data. Why randomly? Well, that's because they want to ensure that recovering from a failure later is as fast as possible. And if the machines are not likely close to each other, it's more likely that they will have survived whatever happened. Okay? That's why they choose them randomly across the different racks. And then this way they will have the best distribution actually inside of the stamp of the data so that they can recover from failures much faster. Okay. So primary, secondary. And once that's done, it will tell the partition server which ones of the machines can talk to. It can only talk to the primary. The partition server has no knowledge about the secondaries. The replication process. So once the partition server starts talking to the primary machine, it will actually accept the data and write it to disk. And then it will make sure that it is bitwise equal in all of the different nodes. So it's synchronously done, appended to the primary disk. They take the position on the disk, the exact offset on the disk where the data is, and forward that offset together with the data to the secondary. The secondary then takes the offset and writes the data on the exact same location on the disk. So they are bitwise equal. They need to maintain that. That one will repeat itself to the secondary, and once the secondary is okay, it will send an acknowledgement back and back. Now what is important is that you can see that there are two disks attached to the extent node, the small one and the big one. The small one is called a journaling disk, and this one is optimized to write to. It's a very small, very fast disk, a spindle of different RAID 0 configured disks, or either an SSD drive. It's very fast and small. It's small because then it doesn't have to spin a lot before it can actually reach the destination where it needs to write. The other one is the data disk, and that's where all the data goes. And this one will be primarily used during read operations. So if you read and it's not hot in memory, then it will go to the data disk and fetch it there. Now, why do they do this? Well, this way they can improve the performance of the machine. Because the big disks, it takes a long time before they get until the position where they might need to write. And you remember, they need to do it three times. And the small disk, they can actually do it very fast because they do not have to position the head of the reader a lot on the, or the writer a lot on the disk. So this way, they will write, and they will write to both simultaneously. And the first one that returns, which is usually this journaling disk, if one of them hits or is finished, then they will say, okay, we're done. While they say we're done, they still continue copying data to the other one. And in case there is a failure during that period, then they have the original data on the journaling disk probably, and they can still pick that and copy it back to the master or to the data disk. Okay? So this is just simply a performance improvement. Two disks, one optimized for writing and the other optimized for storing and reading from. Okay. Once they're all three done, it will return an acknowledgement to the partition server. Right. Now, what if something goes wrong? We mean horribly wrong, right? Now, there are many points where it can fail in the process because there are many machines, there's a network in between, and there's replication, and there can all kinds of stuff can go wrong. Well, we have these different scenarios. Either the primary does not respond to the partition server. In that case, the partition server just simply tries again. This might result in duplicate records on disk. That's why it's important that the partition layer itself has this duplicate detection built in so that it doesn't matter if it retries. Okay. But what if one of the servers was up but one of the other replicas was not? In that case, the stream master will actually seal all of the extents that it's writing to. So this block cannot be written to any of the three replicas. Then it will issue a seal operation to the ones that it can talk to. And it will create new machines, or pick new machines, and create a new extent on the other machines, and send the data there. Okay, that's what's happened. So they will close it off, They have the old data, and they will take a new set of machines and start writing there. Because these extents are sealed, they can never be written to it ever again. Okay. But even then, we have different scenarios, right? Now, what if, or how does this system, this distributed consensus system called the Paxos system, how does it decide what to seal and how to seal? That's the question. Now, in this case, the partition server wishes to write to its primary, which goes well, it succeeds. It forwards to the first secondary, which succeeds as well. Then it wants to forward to the third one, which fails. For whatever reason, the machine might be dead, the network might be dead, there might be a router in between that just died, whatever. But it did fail. Now, in this case, no result will be sent back to the partition server, and it will be instructing the stream master to seal the different extents so that it can append it to a new one. What will happen is the stream master will try to call out to all of the different extent nodes, and it asks, how big are you? What's your commit log length? In this case, the first two machines will give them the new commit log length. They will say 120. Imagine the original one was 100, depended 20 bytes. It will say, I'm now 120 long. The third one does not respond because it's dead. Okay. In this case, the stream master will decide to seal them with the data in it, so with the 120 commit length. Because they have two replicas, this is pretty safe, because the machine, the partition server, can still read the data from the two replicas. It doesn't really need the third one. If the third one then ever comes up again, it can ask one of the other two guys, hey, give me the data. And so it syncs itself up with the original two. Okay, make sense? In the other scenario, where they do not have two replicas, so the first one might succeed and then the second one might fail, in this case, when the seal operation is going to be done, the stream master also asks all of the different services, how big are you? Well, in this case, one returns 120 and the other one returns 100. So there is a difference. What to do? Okay. Well, because in this case it's not safe to say 120 because we only have one replica and we could lose that one as well, we will return 100 because in that scenario we still have two. Okay, so it will seal the extent, and as you might notice there is a question mark on the written block. It will simply forget about it. So it's still written, it's still on the disk, but it will not be taken into account anymore. It's just there doing nothing. If then later the failed one comes up again, then it will seal itself at the 100 marker, so it doesn't have to do anything. Right? Make sense? Obviously, we will return a "Hey, it didn't work" message back to the partition master so that it retries and then creates the other extent. Right? But that's the same in the previous example that might be happening. Okay, that was writing. Now, what if stuff fails during reading? What will we do? Now, then it differs a little bit. If they're just simply writing for data, or they just want to go to the raw data stream or the blob data stream, and it's in the middle of an update, imagine that two of the extents have already been written to and the third one is gone, at least for the stream manager, then the partition server can continue to safely read from any of the machines that it can reach. It could be that it can reach the third one and not the, well, the stream master cannot because of the specific router that went down. Right? So it could safely read from all of the three ones because it will only read from the positions that it knows about. It has never gotten an acknowledgement that the blocks have been written, so it will just simply read to 100 and not to 120. Okay? So it can safely read from any replica that it can actually reach. Now, it's different when going from the log stream. Because as you can remember, the log stream actually contains the exact information of the state of the data. So if it would read from the log stream, it actually has to take all of the data that's already written, or it might lose the data. So it has to take the newly written block into account, even if the third replica has not been confirmed yet. Because otherwise, it cannot completely restore the in-memory state of how things are supposed to be. Now, In this case, the stream master has to be involved in the process. So the partition server first asks to the stream master, well, how big are you guys? What's the commit log? What's the commit log length? How big is it? And in this case, the stream master will try to reach out to all of the machines, and it sees that it cannot reach the turn one. So it decides to seal everything. Even while an update is in progress, it just decides to close everything down, and they will start a new extent somewhere else, because things are pretty unsafe now. You're trying to restore data based on a halfly committed thingy, and then we want to build on top of that. And we consider it the truth because it's the commit log. So it will seal all of them, and it will return to the partition server the server names that it can actually read from. So it will say you can read from 1 and 2, but do not touch 3 because we don't know what its state is. We cannot connect to it. Okay. And of course, it will start reading out, and then a later stage, the third one will also be sealed, or it's gone forever, whatever, then it will never be sealed, but you can't read it from it anymore. Okay, makes sense? Now, there is one very, very big advantage to this architecture. You might have noticed that we very often forget very, very big files. We just forget about them. Whenever we do a replication process, or when we do the checkpoint process, whenever there is a failure, whenever there might be blocks that go missing, there might be entire extents that go missing, there might be streams that go missing, all kinds of data that goes, just sits there, does nothing. That's why there is some kind of garbage collection process involved. It's similar to the garbage collection process used in .NET, but at the disk level. Every partition server will mark the streams that it's working on. And because the streams contain pointers to extents internally, those extents are also known. So the stream master can then start searching on the disks for files which are marked, and then read those files, and then start searching for the other files that are referenced, and also keep track of those. Every file that it finds but cannot find in its processing algorithm can be safely deleted because it's no longer used. It's the same as happens in the memory of a .NET CLR environment. There you have the same thing. They start from a certain list on the stack or the static variables, and it will traverse all the relationships, mark them, and everyone that's not marked at the end of the process can be gone. Same thing here. Right? So those files can be deleted. This is all done by the stream master. What's also done is from the files that remain, they will actually perform some optimization routines called the Reed-Solomon algorithm, or also referred to as erasure coding. What they will do is they will pick the parts of the file, calculate a number from it, it's kind of a hash code that they calculate from it, then they store that hash code on all of the 3 replicas. And if they then ever lose the data, intentionally or not, doesn't matter, then they can still, depending on the original hash code, retrieve it from the other machines and restore everything. And this way they can actually also intentionally delete data. And they can reduce the size where they have normally 3 replicas, they can reduce it to 1.3 to 1.5 of the replicas, safely, because of this system. So this is a major disk space saver for those things. But it's obviously only done on stuff that's not used a lot, right? So, for optimization reasons. Okay, that was the architecture. The architecture that beat the CAP theorem. I might need to replay a little bit of things to point you how they actually did it, because I told you it was a 666 level talk. Now, how they did it? They have 2 layers that are actually responsible for covering the gaps. It's still impossible to build one system that actually defies all of the 3 rules, but it's perfectly possible to combine multiple systems and design them in such a way that one takes care of the failures of the other. And in this way, actually achieve all of the 3 properties. The stream layer itself is highly available because there are multiple nodes with the same data on it. And it's very partition tolerant because of the Paxil system that actually decided across of the different nodes, if one of the nodes is gone, how do we need to respond to this? So this is partition tolerant and available, but it's not that consistent because during the failures, some of the replicas might be out of sync with the primary. It's perfectly possible. On the other hand, we have the partition layer, which is very consistent because of the merge tree. They have the commit log, which is guaranteed, and then merged with the actual data, so that you always have a consistent view of the latest information. No matter what's going on underneath on the stream layer, you always have a consistent view. It's also very partition tolerant because every 15 seconds they just start throwing stuff around. So if a machine goes away, one other one will be taking over. It's not that available because they actually accept that machines will die all the time. That's why they have the dynamic load balancing algorithm after all, right? So we have these two layers. One of them is available and partition tolerant. The other one is consistent and partition tolerant, and they equal each other's limitations out. Now, what is important is that Microsoft has not taken into account every single possible failure. They have only covered those failures that they have seen until now. It's important. There might still be something that they have not taken into account yet. All right. We have 10 minutes left, so I can just simply walk over my way of using the storage services. These are my practices, not the best practices. And one thing is the way that I partition my data. Every time I talk to customers about partitioning data, the first thing that they think about is which partition key am I going to choose. Don't do that. There is a very easy way to decide how to partition your data. And that's by putting every single individual object in another partition. That's the first thing you can actually do, but it's a very good way to start. So what actually happens is I put everything in a separate partition, so that I can actually get very, very performant write operations, because it will only hit one machine if I do need to update my range. I know that, because it's in every single individual partition. But if I need to query things, I might have to query thousands and thousands of machines. It's not really acceptable, right? So this is the strategy that I follow. I will take what I call aggregates, and aggregates are objects that belong together, like an order with its order lines, very common example. And I would put them all into individual dedicated partitions. So I use a unique combination of partition parts, like in this case, the account, the table name, and the partition key. And I will insert into those the order root entity, as well as the order lines. I will always use the primary key of the root entity as the partition key of those records for all of them. And I will be using the row key not as a unique identifier for the order lines, but I will use those for sorting and only for sorting, nothing else. All of the other properties, the business properties of the data, I will put them into the properties. So I will replicate them over. Now, I will use entity group transactions, which is the only kind of transaction supported on one transaction item, to insert the order and the order lines together in one go. So this is a very performant way of inserting things, and it's transactional. So if one of those fails, everything fails. Okay. One hint as well is you do not have to specify a row key. You can leave it blank. So in this case, if you just want the order, you can just specify the primary key of the order as the partition key and grab it. This is a very good way to do get operations, updates of single records, and deletes. Because very performant, you can just simply get one individual item. But when I want to query, this is horrible, because I might have to cross all of the different partitions. So what I do is I do not decide how to partition my data initially. I just partition it all over the place. But then I copy the data into the way that I want to query it. So instead, I will use my partition key actually as my where clause, basically. I will pre-compute everything that I want to query on later and store it like that. So I query upfront. And then again, I use the row key only for sorting, so that if I query, the order is already accurate. Typically, I will use the primary key of the parent, followed by some other identifier of the child, right? So you have to ensure that the combination of partition key row key is unique, so that's why I append multiple properties together to do that. For the rest, all of the properties are simply copied. Okay, this is very different than from traditional database thinking. I do copy data all over the place, right? And I keep it in sync. This guarantees that whenever I do a certain query on, for example, a page or a form, it's always performant because I will only hit one machine, guaranteed. Okay? Now, I also do denormalization. So if I know that a certain form only needs the total of my order lines, then I will pre-calculate it and store it in that record as well. So I'll duplicate again, and then I will put the data into those properties. So this way I ensure that the other form, which needs the data in a very different way, also gets a very performant performance improvement, right? Because if you need to query thousands or millions of machines, it will never be performant. So pre-computation and formatting and stuff like that, I do it up front and I just store it the way that the client needs it. So I will duplicate data a lot of times. Now, some great partition keys that you might want to think about. Any combination of existing properties are great to use as partition keys because that's what you will probably be querying on. So if you do where name and last, first name, last name, etc., combine them, use them as a partition key so you can easily query it. What's also very often is the guy that created it, the user ID, the time that it was created. The best way to do this is in reverse order, starting from the end of time and then subtracting the current time, then storing that. So then it's always stored in reverse order with the most recent first. Right? For location partition keys, so XY coordinates, there's a very nice algorithm called GeoHash, which you can try out on geohash.org, which gives you a nice one string that represents a certain area, depending on how big the string is. Just try it out. You will see it's a very good match for use as partition keys on location. And then also very often the why or the context or why it happened. The slides are on, normally will be released, so you can still take a picture of that. Okay. But one thing that you need to make sure is if you take one of these things that are typically not properties of the business entity itself, you need to add it to the root because otherwise you have all of these copies floating around. Otherwise, if you update the root and then you want to update all of the copies, you need the information to find the copies again. So if you forget, for example, to add the current time to your original entity, you will never be able to find that other record that you have copied. So you need to think about it. Updating, I do it the following way. There is one other big downside to storage that people who think in relational terms have with the thing, is that it does not support transactions. You do not have something like begin transaction, end transaction across different tables, and then it all works magically. It's not the case. It's not the database, as I said. So you have to make sure that if you need to update all of the replicas of the data, that you actually ensure that they happen. But the good thing is the other storage construct called queues, they have a built-in retry mechanism. So that if something fails, they will just simply retry again, and retry again, and retry again, until you say stop, retry. Okay. So this way you can actually overcome those failures that you often see when the partition map is being updated. So you just simply try again. And in this case, I will maintain my primary record, so the one with the individual partition key that's in its own partition. I will get it, I will update it, and store it back. And once it's stored, I will actually issue an event that says that, for example, the object was created or the object was updated. I create that event as a message, I put it in a queue. And I have other machines, logically, might be the same machine, but logically it might be another machine, that pick up that message. They read, this object has been updated, so I need to update that specific secondary copy of it. I have multiples of those, one for each type of query that I want to execute in the system. Okay. Remember, this is not a relational database, so if you think this is very, very hard for your system, then I suggest you use a relational database. It's just a way that you can work with it with data and copies of the data for certain scenarios where you have high volumes of data. So that's what I do. So I have these secondaries that actually update the copies of the other data. Now, the benefit of this, you can talk back to the original one with the same event. So while you're updating all of your secondary indexes, basically, you can already tell your front end, I'm done, because it has this retry mechanism built in, and it will continue to retry until it succeeds. Okay. Now, this is pretty hard, I know, especially if you have to build it by hand. But I've already gone before you, and I've contributed, I've built this kind of system, I've contributed it back as an open source project called nServiceBus that allows you to do all the management, the messaging, the handling and stuff. It's just up to you to implement it specifically for your types of objects. And the bonus is it works very well with other systems like the caches in the web frontends or SignalR. You might have seen the previous talk on SignalR. You can just simply send the created event back to the user. Right? And then he knows, oh, it's done. And hopefully I will be able to offer it as a service as well on my startup project called Message Handler, so that you can just simply click and you have it. So that would be ideal. Okay. Counting, same problem. If you want to count in a database, you do select count. You're done, or select max, whatever. This is pretty much impossible if you have to query across 1,000 machines. Impossible. So again, the same advice, do it upfront. Count while you're actually creating the records and save the counts. And then you can just simply query them later. This has to take into account that you have multiple machines, and on the multiple machines you have multiple threads that need to be counting. So I do this in a concurrent, safe way. And here's a piece of code that does this. What you can do is you can take the current instance ID in Azure, append it with the current thread ID, and then maintain a record in table storage for that specific machine and that specific thread. You just do plus one, plus one, plus one. You will never get concurrency issues because it's only one thread that can actually do it. And you can get a table like that. So where every entry in the table has one part of the counter, and then you just sum it up, and then you know your total counter. Okay? So you count up front, not when the data is stored in table storage. So summing up, very simple, for each over all of them, and you can get them. Make sure all the counters are in the same partition so that you don't have to go look for them in other partitions. Last slide. This roll-up process is also very difficult to achieve because this is typically something timer-based or schedule-based. But you have many, many, many nodes in the system that will all decide at the same moment, I'm going to roll up this stuff. So they will all start counting and all start inserting. It's not good. So you want to have only one of your nodes in Azure to be the master of the roll-up process. This is very similar to the dynamic load balancing thingy. You have multiple partition masters that want to look at the partitioning schema of the major object table, but it can be only one. Remember, they took a lock on the lock server. So they said, well, I want to have a lock. Well, the good thing is these locks are actually exposed through the API of storage through what's called a lease on a blob. It's the same thing. And you can use those leases to actually ask for a lease so that the lock server will lock the data and you are the only one that can actually execute the operation. It's a very, very easy way. There is one guy gone before you called Steve Marks, a technical evangelist for Microsoft, and he has done this for you. All right, so we're done. I don't think we have time for Q&A anymore. There are some resources at the end, so you can try it out. And I thank you for your attention. And if you have questions, you can find me outside to ask. Thank you.